WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
He's played with big bands, he's played in Hollywood and television bands, he's worked as a studio musician, he's led many dates, he's toured the world. He's self-taught. In the 1940s, he played with Charlie Barnett's and Artie Shaw's bands, and then in the 50s, he did a lot of recording and touring with Verve Records and with Jazz at the Philharmonic. A little later, we'll hear him in sessions recorded with Billie Holiday and Fred Astaire. He's recorded under his own name on the Concord Jazz label and on Contemporary Records. He's currently doing a lot of touring. He's holding seminars. He'll be teaching at various universities in the near future. He's also written columns in music magazines. Barnacastle has lived on the West Coast since the 1940s. He's east right now and will be playing tonight and tomorrow night at one of the Delaware Valley's newer jazz clubs. It's called the Flight Deck, and it's located at the airport in Wilmington on the DuPont Highway. And I'd like to just give you a phone number to call if you'd like more information about his appearance at this club. It's area code 302-328-0444. That's 302-328-0444. If you didn't catch it, I'll give it again later. Barnacastle, what a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you very much, Terry. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we kind of get to the present, let's go backwards a little bit. I'm interested in how you started playing guitar and how you started playing jazz. You grew up in what, Muskogee?
Muskogee, Oklahoma. I did not really come from a musical family. I mean, they sort of, my mother might have sung while she's washing the dishes. My father might have been singing a little as he was doing various things around the house, but not really a musical family, not one that stressed musical values. But I used to work in a theater when I was a kid, about 10 years old, and I did many things. I sold popcorn. I was the usher. I sold tickets. I would do a number of things in this theater, but always while the motion pictures were going on. And so I saw movie after movie over and over again. I saw all the musicals in the 30s when I was so young that I had to sit on the armrest of a seat. And these musicals stayed with me, all the songs. And not only did I remember the music, but the words and also the dramatic situation in the picture that led up to the song. Like you say, you take a song like I Only Have Eyes for You. I remember what picture it was in, who did it, how they filmed the scene, and what led into the picture. So that kind of a song would have, or any of the songs that I grew up with, would have greater significance for me than just simply hearing a song done on a record.
Now, a lot of those tunes from the movies have become jazz standards,
yes,
but they certainly weren't done as jazz in the movies.
That's
for the most part.
And many, many things, you know, like you take a tune like Lady Be Good was originally done as a very soft, sweet ballad. Tunes have changed. Some songs were written in 3/4, and now they're done in 4/4 always. They were done in one key to begin with. They're done now. Some of them were done very fast, and now they're the concept of them is very slow, or vice versa. But the main thing was that I was around music in the motion pictures a lot. And also, I got to hear the music that was in the dramatic scoring. I mean, all these early Betty Davis pictures and Joan Crawford. And Warner Brothers particularly comes to mind because they had Max Steiner writing music. And it was very, very heavy dramatic scenes. And being an usher and being a ticket taker and hearing this music and seeing a picture over and over again in the course of a week, I got to where I knew all the lines.
Now, I've often thought that the music that you are exposed to, the first music that you're exposed to when you're young, like from when you're growing up to maybe when you're 10 or 12, might really leave indelible marks on your mind and might really be like the equivalent of the basic of your basic vocabulary, and that when you think musically, that the first things that you've heard are bound to affect the ways that you think musically and what you're capable of thinking musically. Do you think that?
To a certain extent, yeah, I'd say to a certain extent. For the most part, for instance, when I was a kid and we would listen to the radio, the music that was coming out of the radio was coming from places away from where I lived, and therefore the kind of music and the expertness with which it was played was far different than the kind of music I was growing up with. I came from Oklahoma. Everything there was strictly cowboy music, not even what you'd call hillbilly or western swing, but what you'd call cowboy music. The music of Gene Autry, Kumbaya, Yippee, Yippee, that kind of thing. That's what I grew up with, hearing around where I was living. On the other hand, the music that's coming out of the radio were things coming from Hollywood and New York and larger orchestras and playing the pop music of the day.
Do you think that those kinds of musics that you grew up with affected your approach to jazz in any way?
Yes, somewhat. They certainly did affect and do affect right now what I consider to be a good song. For example, when I sit on a bandstand and want to play, I really want to play good music just like someone that's 20 years old or someone that's 80 years old. But my idea of what is good music might be different from theirs.
What are some of the tunes, for instance, that you really love to play now?
Well, for one thing, instead of just naming the tune, I would say that most of what I have heard written by people like Cole Porter, Irving Berlin, Vincent Humans, Rodgers and Hart, but it really doesn't have to be just those. It's just that they did what I wanted to do. They wrote the kind of music. It told the kind of story. It had the right kind of melody to turn me on. It's got the right kind of harmonic construction. On the other hand, there are tunes that come out through the years that every once in a while there's a good song. I mean, you know, Barbara Streisand wrote a beautiful song called Evergreen. I love many things that I've heard Barry Manilow do. I think they're just absolutely knockout songs. I like some songs that I've heard by the Carpenters. There's one called For All We Know of a few years ago. And there is no prejudice in wanting to cling to the songs of the 50s, but today, when I hear a good song, it is an exception. And in those days, it wasn't. And I think one of the reasons, if I could just say why this is that to a great extent, I do believe, I can't measure it statistically, but I do believe that so much of what is put out today as musical production is first guided by money as to what will sell. And it's not that there's this particular musical message burning in the heart of the composer. Everything is written to order. What will we sell? What can we record? We need a hit. What do we do to make a hit?
You know, it's interesting that you take someone like Cole Porter or Rodgers and Hart. A lot of times they wrote songs because they were under great pressure to have like 24 songs for the show that was going to open in three weeks. Although a lot of what they've written are just really incomparable and classics and will endure for a long time. But there was that pressure to produce there.
And it was also, Terry, situations where having written some of these songs, they later found out that there was no time to do the song. And so it was shelved. Not because it was a bad song, but there wasn't time. Or they decided to cut out a certain scene, therefore they didn't need the song for that scene. And there are any number of songs that have been written this way where they just didn't use them, but not because of the merits of the song. There have also been great songs that have been sidetracked due to circumstances. For example, the first record on Nature Boy was made by Nat King Cole on Capitol Records. There was a beautiful song that was recorded on the other side called Lost April. And Lost April is an absolutely exquisite song, but no one would have ever heard it. And the composer of Lost April made as much money on the record sales as the other, because they both split the money on each side of the record. But people do not know Lost April. And it simply got lost because the other side of the record was played.
Do you like to play a lot of the bop standards?
Quite a few, especially the ones written by Charlie Parker. There are many others written by devotees of Charlie Parker, in which they kind of come off like music lessons. And in other words, they've gathered the musical personality of Bob, but they haven't gathered the essence. And so it comes out a little bit contrived. But to a great extent, I like most of Charlie Parker's. I like a lot of Dizzy's, some of Bud Powell's. But there are other people that wrote things during that time, and some of them leave a lot to be desired.
Barney Kessel, when you started playing professionally in the 40s, there was some really different opportunities for a young musician than there are now.
Yes.
There were, for instance, radio orchestras, radio bands, for which you played for a number of those.
Yes.
It's a non-existent concept.
Yes, it
right
is.
Now.
Uh-huh.
What were those positions like? What were those radio jobs like?
It was before television, and so there would be a radio show, and usually it was done twice. From Los Angeles, you would do one broadcast, a complete show for California and the West Coast, you do another one for New York, the East Coast, because there was a three-hour difference. And in those days, the idea of doing it this way is to have that show come through the radio at a good prime time for both areas, so that if you wanted a show to hit 8 o'clock in the evening, it can't hit 8 o'clock in the evening both in Los Angeles and in New York. So they would do it that way. And the bands were big bands. They were very excellent musicians. Usually they were musicians that had come off of road bands, that had played with the big name bands, and decided, the musician decided to stay in one place and build a home or establish a residency. And there were many, many shows. Some were all musical shows, like the Railroad Hour. Some were comedy shows in which the music were only like little funny cues.
We carry old-time radio shows, yeah, between 6:30 and 7 o'clock, you know, on the station. I was listening the other day to some of those funny cues, and like,
yeah. Well, and they have, there were a million bridges, what they call bridges, you know, where the guy, it's almost like a fade out on one scene, says, well, I'll see you tomorrow, says, okay, and they go, and they go, come in, you know, and it's like it's a new scene. So there were shows that had those kind of things that were bridges, these little things.
And yes. There's a lot of, you know, Hollywood movies about, like Young Man with a Horn, for instance,
yes,
which is kind of like loosely based on Big Spiderback.
Yes.
And Kirk Douglas, who plays,
yes,
the lead, is always playing in some pop-type band,
yes,
the equivalent of Paul Whiteman, and just really chafing at the bit to really...
do his thing.
To do his thing,
yeah,
to improvise, to play with the band. And of course,
yeah,
the hit members of the band would always sneak out late at night and,
sure,
and improvise together.
Yes.
Did stuff like that really happen in the radio band?
Yes,
where
it happened.
Confined to playing,
yes,
bridges?
It happened. But Young Man was a horn with a Horn really doesn't really depict the way that it is. For instance, I recall in that picture, I think Kirk Douglas made a mistake, and so they called off a record date. Well, you don't call off a record date because someone has a mistake. You've got thousands of dollars invested. If you make a mistake, you say, take two, let's try it again, or take 50. You simply don't just stop. So what he did there was taking a great license with the reality, the way that it is, and so many of the things that depict musicians are totally unreal. I recall for years, anytime it showed in the 30s and the 40s, anytime it showed a band in a motion picture, and they weren't playing, but they had to be up there doing some kind of business, invariably the leader of the orchestra had one stock line that he would always say, and it didn't matter who wrote the picture or who wrote the screenplay, it was always the same line. The band gets through playing, and they show the musicians there, and the leader looks at the band and says, okay, guys, take five.
Right.
They were going through life taking five.
No one really said it, huh?
No, I mean, and not nearly that much.
Uh-huh.
You did ask me a question earlier about how I started. I just wanted to tell you,
yeah,
quickly. After working in the theaters and listening to the music, I also sold newspapers. Very enterprising and involved in business. And so I was selling newspapers, and when I was 12, I was selling newspapers on a corner in Muskogee, Oklahoma, and there was a guitar in a window in a pawn shop there. And it was a new guitar, and they were really offering quite an attractive offer to me. And this guitar could be purchased for $1, a new guitar, and with it you got a two-colored tassel cord that you could tie around the guitar to hold, and a book, all for $1. And the book was titled How to Play the Guitar in 5 Minutes.
That's great.
So I didn't know it was going to take 10, Terry.
Right. No, I understand. Wow, that really does sound like a movie, though. I mean, that's the,
yeah,
kind of scene that is almost in Young Man with a Horn, and it's in a lot of movies. And I say, oh,
yeah,
right, sure.
Yeah.
So you really got
but
started with
that's how it started,
show.
And I'd never had any lessons, and I just had the guitar for a little while, and I strummed it and played open chords and didn't really learn to play anything. I was trying to learn to play things like Farmer in the Dell and London Bridge is Falling Down. The first thing I ever learned to play was da 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 da. I tried to play that. I couldn't find all the notes. And then I put it away. I put it in a clothes closet, and I didn't touch it. I was so crazy about it. And then, like a kid, the thing you're crazy about today is something you can't even find tomorrow because you don't know where you put it. It's just a fad. I put it away in a clothes closet. My mother finally told me, she said, you're either going to have to play this thing or we're going to have to get rid of it because it's just taking up space and collecting dust. And so I looked at it again and rediscovered it again for the second time. I fell in love with it the second time, and this time it was for keeps. And had the benefit, a school was letting out for the summer, and I had the benefit of taking some music lessons all summer in a music program sponsored by the federal government, believe it or not. There was a program under Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration called the WPA, and an adjunct of that was a thing called a Federal Music Project. And you could take free lessons sponsored and paid for by the government. And so I did. I took lessons all through the summer vacation, 6 days a week, 4 hours a day.
Oh, wow.
So it was a lot of lessons.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Barney Kessel. We're going to be listening to various recordings that you've made, and I'd like to listen to one of them now.
Okay,
and this is
great.
A session from the late 50s that has just been reissued on Verve Records, and it's a recording that you did with Billie Holiday. We're going to hear What's New.
Okay.
Can you remember this session for us?
I cannot remember this particular session. Sometimes I could remember something if something happened that was funny or strange or different in some way, but I'll tell you, there was a period of about 18 years in Hollywood where I did 3 record sessions a day, 5 days a week. And so it's like eating donuts every day, and for 10 years and somebody's asking you, what day in the last 10 years did you have that cinnamon donut? I mean, you can't remember. Had I only done 2 or 3 record dates, I would have remembered everything, but I don't remember. I do recall recording with Billie Holiday several times, and I do recall certain instances, but I cannot just in my mind pick out what's new.
Can you talk at all about what your approach was when you were playing with her? You know, because you haven't recorded that much, I think, with vocalists. And
quite a bit, though.
Oh,
quite a
okay.
Bit. I've recorded with Ella Fitzgerald, Barbara Streisand, Frank Sinatra, Bing Crosby.
I take it all back.
Yeah.
She is known as being like really behind the beat. Did you have to adjust your playing in any
Not at
way,
all,
playing
no,
with her,
because,
or did you give her a certain support? Or
yes, certain support. But had I gone with her, then we would all be behind the beat, and then we're all behind. In other words,
right, there's
She's only behind the beat because the beat is not behind, and because it's working against that focal point. You see, we just played, but she always caught up, and that was her charm. It didn't seem to bother her, and it really wasn't wrong. It was just her way of doing it, and she ended up right. We started right, we ended right.
Okay, well, let's hear this recording. It was made, this was made actually in 1955. We're going to hear What's New with Billie Holiday. Benny Carter, Jimmy Rowles, Harry Edison, John Simmons, and Larry Bunker are featured on this. My guest, Barney Kessel, is the guitarist.
What's new? How is the weather treating you? You haven't changed a bit. Lovely as ever, I must admit. What's new? How did that romance come through? We haven't met since then. Gee, but it's nice to see you again. What's new? Probably I'm mowing you, but seeing you is grand, and you were sweet to offer your hand. I understand, I do. Pardon my asking, what's new? Of course, you couldn't know. I haven't changed. I still love you so.
Recorded in 1955, Billie Holiday, with my guest Barney Kessel featured on guitar. Barney Kessel is in the Delaware Valley now. He will be performing in Wilmington tonight and tomorrow night at a club called The Flight Deck, which is right near the airport. The Billie Holiday album that we just heard has just been reissued on Verve Records. It's just come out in the past few months. Did you know that was out, Barney?
No, I didn't.
Do you get notified by record companies when your work gets reissued?
No, you don't. As a matter of fact, the people that play on the records really would have no way of knowing about it. The only ones that have to be informed would be someone who was the featured artist at that time, since they had a record contract with the company, and also publishers of the songs. They would have to be notified through collection agencies like ASCAP or BMI.
So the company reissuing this has no further monetary obligation to you? You got paid for the session, and only the composer, the publisher, and the person
artist,
whose name it was made under would see any further money.
Yes, that's right. And and even as an artist, if I were the artist on the record, I might not have any say-so in the new design of the album cover, or what they chose to delete, or if they decided to add echo or put in a stereo effect. I'd have nothing to say about that unless it was in my contract originally that I did have.
You've been on both ends of this, because you've been an A&R man at Verve,
yes.
And you've also recorded lots and lots of albums. Do you think that it would be common courtesy for a record company to let the people who appear on a date know when that date is reissued?
It would be courtesy, but we're not living in that kind of world today. Those values would cause a business to deteriorate and suffer. Nice guys, I can tell you any number of companies where everyone in it has been a sweetheart, a nice guy, and the business is folded. It's strictly a dollars and cents operation. For all the time that they take to type out letters and mail and send things out to tell people as a courtesy, they could be doing something to collect on unpaid bills or find out a way to move their inventory, and that's what they're doing. It's just a larger populated world today, and we don't have time for those kind of social graces. I mean, I personally, on a personal level, do have and enjoy it and want to extend that and receive that. But in the world of reality, we don't have time for those kind of social graces.
Well, you've recorded for really kind of small labels,
yes,
where it's not a huge major operation,
yes,
something like Concord or Contemporary,
yes,
where it's I wouldn't call it a mom and pop operation,
no,
but it's pretty pretty much smaller.
Limited
than
distribution and dealing mostly with jazz rather than it being an adjunct of a larger pop or disco type of thing in which they're simply doing this for kicks or to add some kind of so-called, in quotes, culture to their label.
Do you have a preference as an artist as far as recording for, you know, a large label or a small label or a label that has a lot of different sections to it or a label that's completely jazz?
I think in today's world, I don't think that one label can do any more as far as the production of a record than any other. I don't think that one company is capable of making a better record than another, and I don't think that you can make a better record in Tulsa, Oklahoma than you can in Philadelphia or in Hollywood or New York or Chicago, because by this time, equipment is standardized, and that same microphone will work the same way in Dallas as it does in Cleveland. And engineers, by and large, except for great, great creative, imaginative forces, pretty much work within certain prescribed concepts. And
what about producers, though? Because that seems to be a really important variable. Because,
yep,
you know, a producer can give you a lot of freedom or can basically dictate to you what,
yes,
style you should play,
yes,
in and what the final product should sound like.
Uh-huh. Well, they do differ, and some producers want to catch the essence of what it is you have to offer, and other producers want to simply channel what you have into a vehicle that they have in mind. And usually the one that they have in mind is one that they might feel that you have a basic ability, but that you're not directing your energies towards getting a hit. So they say, don't do this song, do this other song, do song number two, and don't do it playing in the high register, play in the low register, and put it in the key of D, not in the key of E flat, and play it a little bit slower, and I think we've got a hit.
Do you like that, or...?
Yeah, I like that in one way. It all depends on if what they're telling me isn't foreign to my own values and seeks to enhance it. I would say it's almost like serving a roast beef, that the roast beef is very good the way that it is, but if somebody says, why don't we put a little salt on it and add some mustard, and you do, and you've enhanced the roast beef without taking away the characteristic of it, I think it's great. But I think when it suddenly changes and it no longer tastes like roast beef, you've got something else. So I welcome any suggestions that simply enhance what I'm doing and channel it in a more favorable way.
In the 1950s, in the session that we heard, for instance, with Billie Holiday, you worked with Norman Granz, who,
yes,
was the producer of that day,
yes,
and who produced the album we're going to be hearing in a few minutes,
yes,
with Fred Astaire. What was he like to work with as a producer?
Well, it was a very simple approach. He just turned on the equipment and let everybody play. As a matter of fact, his thoughts at the time I thought were a little extreme. I've thought about him later, and I think he's closer to being right than I used to think that he was closer to being right. And that was, he says that he told me several times, he says, Barney, you'll find out that as you play these songs, that more and more, the best take will be the first one. Because there's a freshness. It's like falling in love for the first time. I mean, it can always get better, but it's never like it is at the beginning. So you make this song, it's new, you're playing it, you're feeling a certain thing about it. Everything is vibrant, everything is new. The more you play a thing, you may play it in such a way that you eliminate mistakes, but it gets what is called slick. As it gets slick and you get it under your fingers and you get a better understanding, it also becomes more contrived and you fall into things that you do. And therefore, in one way, you don't make as many mistakes, but it doesn't have the spontaneity and the freshness.
So you think more and more that
yeah,
is
the
true.
First takes.
Do you, on the album that we heard at the beginning of,
yes,
our discussion, your new one on Concord, Soaring, what was your approach to that as far as takes?
Pretty much the same. I do not record the way most people record today. I do not wear earphones. I do not play over tracks. I do not play with a rhythm section where each person is compartmentalized in a little sort of a partition, where they can get isolation from the recording. You know, it's the whole idea is the way things are set up today, they're set up so that the musician records in a way that's very convenient for the engineer. It helps him to separate things, but it isn't good for the musician.
Because you can't see one another.
No, you can't
really
see one
react.
Another, and you shouldn't be listening to each other through earphones. The greatest jazz records in the world were made without earphones. They were made without partition. And just having a clean recording is not the ultimate thing. What that's doing is it's making sure that the message you get comes loud and clear. I'm more interested in what is in the essence of the message. I'm more interested in what you're saying rather than what equipment it's coming over.
Will most record companies allow you to do that?
No, they won't. No. Because they're all, in a sense, intimidated into feeling that they're less than adequate unless you go with the latest thing. We as a country, we feel that we want the latest thing because in many cases, it's the right thing. Because when you get involved in medical technology, it's the right thing to work with the latest findings. It's the right thing to work with the latest drugs medically. And so we carry this over into creative fields, but it's a different thing. Just because something is new doesn't make it good. The new automobiles today are not as good as the old ones. The metal in them are not as good. The price keeps going up. The performance is not as good.
If you're just joining us, my guest is guitarist Barney Kessel, and he's in the Delaware Valley now. He'll be performing at a club called the Flight Deck, which is one of the Delaware Valley's newer jazz clubs. It's located in Wilmington by the airport. And I'd like to listen to another one of your sessions, also from the 1950s, also
okay.
Something that was from Verve, produced by Norman Granz. This has recently been reissued, though very few people know about it. It's a session that you did with Fred Astaire. I'm crazy about this. Do you remember this at all?
Yes, I do, because there were quite a few sessions. It was a very large thing. Tell me, Terry, did they reissue the whole thing?
Well, there's three records.
Three records.
So, now, I don't know how much there was initially, but most of it is with Fred Astaire singing, but there's about four cuts where it's just the musicians jamming and all call things like a dancer's blues, a slow dancer's blues.
Uh-huh. Does he tap dance?
He taps on one of them, yeah.
But I think we may have made more than this,
mm-hmm.
and they just decided to package it this way.
What do you think of Astaire as a singer?
Well, I think totally he's just an outstanding talent, just an outstanding talent. He is a singer that pleases the fellows that wrote the songs. In other words, when Irving Berlin wrote certain songs, he not only wrote the song, he wrote it for Fred to sing. That's the highest compliment you can do. And the reason they like Fred Astaire is because when he sings, you can hear the words. And another thing is, he doesn't take that many liberties by doing all these vocal nuances and vocal gyrations, which, again, is his approach. I can understand someone getting up and saying, I want to give it my treatment, and, you know, they're doing a Betty Carter or they're doing a thing like that. That's a Sarah Vaughan, you know, moving around all over the place and doing their own variation. But the reason that the songwriters liked Fred Astaire is that he sang the song the way they wrote it.
Have you listened to this lately?
No, I haven't. Love to hear it.
Let's listen to it now. The guitarist on this is my guest, Barney Kessel, the vocalist, Fred Astaire.
A fine romance with no kisses. A fine romance, my friend. This is your calmer than the seals in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. A fine romance with no clinches, a fine romance with no pinches. You're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. I haven't got a chance. This is a fine romance. Thank you.
Never give the orchids I send a glance. No, you like cactus plants. This is a fine romance.
Recorded in 1952, Fred Astaire. Vocals, my guest Barney Kessel. Featured on guitar, Oscar Peterson was the pianist. I'd like to talk a little bit about the way you develop a solo. What from a tune are you going to be thinking about? I know it must vary. Mm-hmm. When you're building a solo, like, to what effect do you take into account the chord changes or the melody? Is one more important than another to you when you're soloing?
Well, I think the most important parts of a song would be, first of all, I think the words, if there are words. The words are the most important part, because words in the language that we speak have a deeper meaning than anything else. Music, color, the scent of something all contribute to a lesser degree in telling a story or telling us about something, but I think that the words are the most important. Secondly would be the melody. Now, if there are no words, then the most important thing would be the melody. There certainly are many memorable melodies that have lasted for hundreds of years that people recall and are affected by. And you take a thing like, a very simple thing like Liebstrom. You take Clair de Lune. You take very, very simple things. Our own songs like America, My Country, 'Tis of Thee. These things may be very simple, but they're singable, they're rememberable, they are something that have great meaning for us. So I do take into account the melody. I also take into account the harmony, but I don't intellectualize the harmony. In other words, by this time in my own development, when I hear harmony, I sense what it is, as though someone were a tailor and they simply feel a material. They know whether it's silk, they know whether it's wool, they know what the garment is. And when I hear a chord, I'm more involved in what kind of texture is it than it's B-flat minor 7, and that I can look into the books that I bought from the Music University and Downbeat Magazine, and I can find out what scales I can play against it. I'm not into that. What I wanted to do is I want to hear a harmony, and that harmony conveys a musical environment. All of a sudden, I am spewed and sprayed and engulfed in the world of B-flat minor 7, and I feel it. I'm swimming in B-flat minor 7, but I don't want to know that it's B-flat minor 7. I want to feel what it feels like, and then I want to get a reaction from myself as to what do I feel about being in B-flat minor 7. Just as if I would say to you right now, if I said to you, I'm going to mention a word, and I want you to tell me the first impression you get when you hear it. I'll say, San Francisco. And you'll say, gee, I had some good food in San Francisco. Or you say, I left my heart in San Francisco. Or you say, I've never been, but I want to go. But the fact is, that word was a stimulus, and it produced something in you. You couldn't have possibly known what you're going to say, because you didn't know what I was going to say as the key word. Now, when I get that kind of harmonic environment and feel the texture of what I'm in at that point, the next question comes, here I am hearing this B-flat minor 7. What is my reaction to it? What do I want to play against this? And what I want to play at that moment might not be what I would play 5 minutes or 5 years from then. And so it becomes more spontaneous, more natural, and more from within yourself. Rather than saying, well, before I play anything and before I even sense what this is, what is the name of this chord and what are the notes in it and what alternative scales can I use against it? This is intellectualizing something that should be emotional.
But does this emotional ability come only after you can play B minor 7th in your sleep? I mean, does it come only after you have played that scale and the notes within that chord so many times that you don't have to be reminded what's in it? You don't have to think about what it is.
Yes and no. Yes and no. You might sense this and play it emotionally and play it correctly without knowing intellectually what it is, because you have the talent to hear certain passages. On the other hand, the fact that you have played it intellectually for so long and have it under your fingers is no guarantee that you will within yourself ever make a transfer to the emotional side of yourself. Some people play for many years and keep getting more and more technical and more complicated without still reaching that part of them that is their real deepest self.
You've done, I believe, a lot of teaching, and I know you've written columns on the guitar.
Yes.
What's your approach to teaching people how to improvise?
First of all, I don't think that really any teacher can teach. I think that really what a teacher is in any field, I think a teacher is a way shower. I think a teacher can see that you're coming to a fork in the road and they can say to you, I believe I would take the right road and not the left, because if you take the left, it's full of holes and it's muddy and you're going to get your tires caught in some mud there, but you can't make them do it and you can only point it out. Secondly, I think that a teacher cannot tell you anything, but I think that you can extract a lot from a teacher by pulling on a teacher's coat and saying, I want to learn this, I want to learn this. You can extract it from him or her, but a teacher cannot teach you, but you can get it from the teacher by grabbing for it. And as far as improvising, I certainly don't in any way discredit intellectual grasping of music, to learn scales, to learn note, to learn the theory of it. I think it's very important and necessary. But as soon as possible, people have to realize that at its finest, at its richest, music is an emotional experience. And just because you do pursue it intellectually is no guarantee that you will get it emotionally. And this comes from being able to feel. It comes from being able to view something and cry. It comes from being able to speak to someone and tell them that you're sorry. It comes from a development of a person being able to express his own nature, that the emotions can come in. Otherwise, people have such a heavy facade that they are unreachable. They're in a fortress going through life, living in a fortress. And that kind of person, when they play, will exhibit intellectual acquirements, but there will be no emotion.
Bernie Kessel, I know that you have recorded sessions which included saxophonist Teddy Edwards, who was here on Fresh Air. He's also usually in the West Coast, and he was east last summer, and he was on the show for a while.
Uh-huh.
And he said something which I'd like to kind of ask you about. He said that, you know, he's played in some television studio bands, and he said, believe me, when Carson's sitting up there with all these people on the couch, there's more talent in the band that night than there is on that couch usually. What are your reactions about, you know, how do you feel about playing in television bands and the kinds of music that gets played?
Thoroughly underwhelmed by it. it's a gig. It's a job. It's not too much fun. I sure did it a lot, and it buys groceries. But even the people there usually are very tired, and they're not really playing up to what they can do. I mean, it's a service. It's providing a particular musical mood or musical bridge that they need there. But again, it doesn't really involve a lot of self-expression. I don't enjoy it too much, and I find that I don't enjoy musical things or artistic things wherein the product has been conceived, produced and distributed mainly with money being the number one thing. I certainly don't mind it being number two, and it's number two in my life, but I think here's my feeling on it, Terry. Anything that is made with money as the first consideration can never become art. But something that starts as art may possibly be sold for money.
That was very well put, and I just completely lost what I wanted to mention to you. Let me just think a second. I'm thinking of it. Remind everyone that I'm in the studio with Barney Kessel, who's on the East Coast. He's usually on the West Coast, and he's going to be playing tonight and tomorrow night at the Flight Deck, which is a club right by the Wilmington Airport. The music that gets played in television settings, as you put it, is usually just like little bridges, unlike what we're used to hearing on the radio. But I've heard, and I don't know if this is true, you've done enough traveling, you probably know this, I've heard in Europe and in some European countries and in Israel, I've heard, the music that gets played on the quiz shows, like behind the announcer saying, okay, you've got 10 seconds, is jazz, that you can hear Coltrane records used on commercials. Have you found this to be true?
Yes. Yes.
Maybe you can explain why that is happening in other countries and why stuff like that never gets on TV here.
Most of the programs I hear that are that way are government-subsidized programs, and they usually don't have commercials. And so they have a greater choice of records that they're playing. It's different, though, when you have sponsors, and those sponsors want to create a certain image. And they don't want a jazz image, it's not so much even sometimes that they don't want a jazz image, but they may want a certain image. Maybe they're selling something, and what they're selling, they want to appeal to young newlyweds buying this thing. And so the music will be disco, or it will be something of a current thing, which is trying to align with their product. It all has to do with the image that you're trying to create.
You've done arranging for television commercials, right?
Yes.
I always wonder what it's like for someone like you to do that. Because are you going to do your best? Are you going to do what musically excites you most for a television commercial, which isn't really your art, and it's not? No one's really going to know that it's you who arranged it. If I see the commercial, I'm not going to know that unless you tell me. On the other hand, it is your work, and you probably want to do the best, but it's a job that has to be done.
Yes.
It's not art. Yes. It's a commercial.
Yes.
What of yourself will you put into that?
Only my experience, not maybe a certain amount of talent, but not my self-expression, because that's not what's wanted. They don't really want Barney Kessel, and they don't want a particular jazz thing, or they don't really want my best. They don't want so much what is my best as they want what is appropriate. And for it to fit, it's got to fit the situation. And so you're doing a cat food commercial, and you got a cat eating some food out of a bowl, and it's got to be something that goes along with that picture. And not only should it not, the music should not duplicate what is being shown pictorially, it should actually reach out and grab another dimension that cannot be said with the picture, but which allows you through the picture and the music to get a greater comprehension of what they're trying to say. The music shouldn't duplicate, and it shouldn't even serve as a reinforcement. It should serve as telling another part of this story that cannot be said pictorially or with words. So you use the music.
Can you tell us which are some of the commercials that you've arranged for?
I did a whole series of Rice Krispie commercials years ago when there was a group called the Monkees. Well, when they were on television, there were some commercials that would come on during their show. And they had nothing to do with it, but it was their show. And I did those commercials, among others. There's Friskies, cat food, dog food. There's something that was done with in which a lady was singing the words to Tangerine. Figurine, I think, is a commercial.
Yes, that's right.
And singing the words of Tangerine, and Nestle's chocolate. I did Perry Mason show, on television.
Did you write the theme for that?
Not the theme, but did some of the music for it. Yeah, and the answer though is in the commercial field, you stay fairly nameless unless you get a credit, of course. But the thing is to do the job.
Now, another aspect of the work that you've done, and I just found out about this when you came here today, is being a guitarist with some rock and roll sessions. You've worked with who? Yes. Elvis Presley, the Beach Boys?
Four pictures with Elvis Presley. I recorded a song, several, but mainly the one that comes to mind with the Beach Boys. I recorded a song called Good Vibrations.
Oh, great.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And I recorded a song with the Righteous Brothers called You've Lost That Lovin' Feeling.
Oh, no kidding. You're on that?
And I recorded with Tina Turner.
Uh-huh. Which one?
I can't think of Mountain High or something like that. Or
Mountain High, River Low, is that there?
Yeah, I think so.
You know, I really wish on records like that they gave personnel, because there's just, I mean, I'd love to have known you were on that, and there's no way of knowing unless you're really a kind of a...
I did the first 10 records with Sonny and Cher.
No kidding.
Yeah, Jan and Dean, Gary Lewis and the Playboys. You know, just on and on. But I never was really a rock musician. What they would do, Terry, in those days is they would get the nucleus of a studio band and they would sweeten it with a few people that really did whatever it was. Like if it was a country western record, they would get a studio band and then it would add a real country banjo player and a real country fiddle player to this band, and it worked out better. Because if they only used studio man, it didn't sound authentic. If they used only country musicians or only rock musicians, because of their lack of experience in studios, it would take a long, long time to get it done. And then if they made changes, that would be a big, big, major catastrophe. But the flexibility of the studio musicians to go any way was good. So the best way that these productions worked out was to have for the most part, a middle-aged studio band and a bunch of younger guys who played the particular flavor they're trying to do.
Did you enjoy a lot of those sessions?
Some of them.
You've lost that loving feeling. I consider that to be a great classic.
Uh-huh.
Love that.
Well, it was written by a guy named Phil Spector. Phil Spector is a personal friend of mine. He has a very enviable record in the recording field. I mean, his track record. Phil Spector produced 11 records, single records, and out of the 11, the first 10 became in the top 10. So I don't see anybody doing that these days, you know, that they make 10 records in a row and are all in the top 10. But he did it. He's a friend of mine. And
what's he doing now?
Well, he's really... mostly working with reissues of some of his material, and he's worked on a few. He worked not really popularly known, but he worked on a few of the Beatle productions. He was involved in some of their things, I think, with Sergeant Pepper and Revolver, and I think some of those. But he lives in Los Angeles, but he's doing very well. And every so often, there's another one of his Oldie But Goodies album is one of his that reissues, or it's a big hit in England, and he does very well with them.
Mm-hmm. What's your relationship to the records you've been on? Do you have a copy of everything that you've recorded?
Or no, I don't.
You just kind of like lose touch with that session after you leave the studio?
Yes, because in most of them, I worked as a sideman. You know, I did records for 25 years, and about 18 of those years, I would do 3 sessions a day.
Mm.
And they weren't my records. I mean, many of them did not reflect my musical taste. I might be playing with a very wide range of artists, and they wouldn't be records I would even care to have. And I don't even have all of the records that I made for myself. I've made maybe 35 albums under my own name. I don't have them all. I'm constantly visiting people in their homes, and they have records that not only do I not have, but I don't even remember doing it.
Let's hear a selection from your most recent record. Okay. This is the record called Soaring. It's on Concord Jazz, and it features my guest Barney Kessel in a trio setting. Barney Kessel on guitar, Monty Budwig bass, and Jake Hanna drums. We're going to hear Star Eyes. Would you like to say a few words before we hear it?
Well, it's just a beautiful song, and it's a medium tempo, and I think this is really kind of me at my best. I love to play fast tunes, and I love to play ballads, but I think... probably just what you call a medium, juicy, groovy tempo is the most fun. And this is what this is.
Okay, well, let's hear Star Eyes, my guest Barney Kessel, guitar. Star Eyes, my guest Barney Kessel, on guitar from his most recent album on the Concord Jazz record label. The album is called Soaring. I'd like to know, Barney Kessel, of the many albums that you have recorded, which are some of your favorites?
Well, I'm happy to say that the one you are just playing now, Soaring, on Concord, I would regard as my best album. I usually have never thought about which is the best album because they have been very close. One has been similar to another as far as the output. But I do think this just came out the best of any album and really comes closest to depicting how I play in person at this time. Although I've been told by many people that when I am heard in person that it is different than on record and far better.
Mm-hmm.
So I would think that would be the best one. I would say that the ones that are my favorites would be another album on Concord called Barney Plays Kessel, in which I have 9 originals. Also, another album with Herb Ellis, the two of us together, simply called Barney Kessel and Herb Ellis. And then just several albums that I made for contemporary records with various combinations, various instrumentation, with horns, with woodwinds, with brass. And 5 albums under the contemporary label, specifically called The Pole Winners, with Shelly Mann and Ray Brown.
Mm-hmm.
We did 4 of those during the 60s, And then there was a 15-year break, and we did a fifth one. And I enjoyed those very much. I enjoyed many records that I did for Norman Granch with Verve when he had that label. I enjoyed them at the time that we did the ones with Billie Holiday, some that I've done with Ella Fitzgerald, some that I have done with Lester Young, many things I did as part of the Oscar Peterson Trio. These would be among my favorites. I did a beautiful record with Julie London called Cry Me a River, and an album called Julie Is Her Name. And I would just say offhand, without thinking further, these would be some of the best records that I made.
Who, to you, are some of the most important jazz guitarists in the history of jazz?
Well,
put that
way. I'll tell you what, I can comment up to the present time. I have made it a habit not to really talk about guitarists in present time, neither good nor bad, not as an avoidance mechanism, but because so often I'm misquoted, and I don't think it's ethical, really, to discuss
that.
Others.
Yeah.
But as far as those who are not living today, mm-hmm. I can certainly discuss them. And I think that as far back as I can remember, from the beginning that my ears ever picked up, as far as jazz, I think people like a guy named Lonnie Johnson and Eddie Lang were the first that were doing something and really making it special and moving towards having a jazz voice. It certainly didn't have great refinement at that time or real center to it, a real direction. It was mostly just playing the guitar, but seeking to break away from only an accompaniment role and improvise and take some courses. And I think that after that, there were people that came up like Al Casey, a guitarist who played with Fats Waller years ago, and Eddie Durham, who played one of the very first to play the electric guitar. And
what about Freddie Green?
Freddie Green played rhythm, only rhythm. And it's a very curious thing. He occupies a very curious position because he's very prominent in the Count Basie band, and what he does is very important. What he does and the prominence that it achieves would never be that discernible if the pianist didn't play like Count Basie, because Count Basie leaves a lot of holes. He leaves a lot of wide open spaces. This is filled by the guitar. Now, if you had a pianist playing that was just all over the keyboard, this thing that Freddie Green can do would not be that apparent. It would not be that appropriate. So it's a beautiful thing that what he does, he can do his thing because it works in with Count Basie doing his thing. And I think that those guitars that I mentioned finally culminated into someone that came along after that and synthesized it all and put it together, which is Charlie Christian. And I think he became really the first definitive jazz voice that could take a guitar solo and play, not just and where you'd say he's good for a guitar player, but where you said his lines, his solo, were just as good as any of the horn players. That had not really come about until then. There are many unsung heroes along the way, people that wouldn't be heard of or known, people like Teddy Bunn, and a guitarist that was killed very early in... I can't think of his name at the moment. I just can't think of it at the moment. But right on through to, people like Django Reinhardt, mm-hmm. Wes Montgomery.
Has it ever happened to you that you've heard a young guitarist and had the strong sense that they've been listening to your records?
Not only had the strong sense, but I can even tell you which records they listened
right.
to. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure.
How do you react to that?
I'm not too thrilled. No, I'm not flattered. No, mm-hmm. no. I think someone said
Someone said imitation is the highest form of flattery. Someone else said that's plagiarism.
That imitation is highest form of plagiarism. No, I can't. It's not a compliment. It's not a compliment because, you see, when they play this way, they don't wear a sign saying I'm playing like so-and-so. I mean, someone comes up and says that's marvelous, and they say thank you.
Right.
They say thank you very much. But I think you can take about as much credit for that as you can some woman is trying to look like Jackie Onassis. Or Elizabeth Taylor or Farrah Fawcett. I mean, so you look like somebody else. Well, what does that do for you, and where are you? Where are you? Where's your center? What are you saying? You know, you just can't go through life that way. Then the cop out that I hear many times is, well, you have to learn somewhere. Well, then learn and put a sign on that you're a student. Don't, when you're out there for keeps as a professional, you're grown, you're mature, and you're supposed to be out there like everybody else saying your thing. And if you are a student and you're gathering data, then don't come on as though you have a very important message, because that message has already been stated.
You have been doing a lot of touring, 3 continents a year, I think is what you told me.
Yes,
you
know, the last 7 years.
Doing some touring here on the East. Do you enjoy that? Do you enjoy being on the road that much?
Yes, I do, very much. I don't enjoy one-nighters. I don't enjoy missing planes. I don't enjoy finishing playing at 2 o'clock in the morning and have to be on a plane at 8. But that doesn't happen very often. And this may be just a way of philosophically living with it, but I realize and reason that every profession has its good and negative points. A doctor has to get up and go take care of a pregnant woman in the rain. The mailman has to come out when it's snowing. And so every profession has its negative aspects. But I am so grateful to be alive, in good health, playing the music that I want, having enough people that enjoy it that I am able to make a good living, and I do exactly what I want to do. And I think in this world, at this time, it's almost impossible. So I feel very rich and grateful.
Well, it's been great to share in your enthusiasm and in your music and in your stories this afternoon. Barney Kessel, I want to thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, and thank you for a most sensitive and perceptive interview.
Well, thank you. Barney Kessel is in the Delaware Valley. He will be playing at a club called the Flight Deck tonight and tomorrow night, and that club's located in Wilmington. It's at the airport on the DuPont Highway, and I'll give you a number you can call for more information about his appearance. It's area code 302-328-0444. That's area code 302-328-0444.